You are listening to a free podcast of The Majority Report with Sam Cedar. To support the show and receive nearly an hour extra material daily, become a member today at majority.fm. Resistance is futile.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar. It's time to look in the mirror, America. Do you like what you see?
I keep referring to Obama as the magic Negro.
Do you like what you see now?
Well, suck on this.
It's just a mirror, America.
Shared sacrifice by everybody.
What could it do to you except reflect your image?
I did nothing wrong at the Minneapolis airport.
The Majority Report.
Far more credible to me than PBS and Frontline.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
If I get the feeling you've been cheated.
It is Tuesday, April 5th, 2011. My name is Sam Cedar, and this is The Majority Report. We are broadcasting live in the literal, though not metaphorical, shadow of the New York Times building in the fashionable Dollar Lunch District of New York City. Today on the program, the Republicans in a mad dash to shut down the government, maybe permanently, frankly. They want to shut it down in a week, but maybe they'll just keep it shut down for all they believe in the value of providing government services. We will talk about that on the program today. We'll also hear from, we'll hear some audio of Victoria Jackson, just because she's so damn crazy, and we all need a laugh. We'll also give you an update on the Supreme Court, the recent decisions from the Supreme Court, ensuring that we have corporate control in this country. And speaking of Supreme Court, also an update on that race in Wisconsin taking place today. But let's jump right in here, shall we, ladies and gentlemen, on this rainy Tuesday here in the fashionable Dollar Lunch District. I should also give you just a programming note before we begin, or as we begin. It's part of our beginning. It seems that Kyle, our tech guru, has now crossed the threshold of 500 followers on Twitter. And that has provided us with the opportunity to get phone system. What are you telling me? That my mic is not good? Physically?
Yeah, physically.
Well, I can't get any closer to my face. What are you talking about?
No, just up.
What do you mean up?
Yeah,
up.
Like that. Yeah, there you go.
All right. God. I get nagged when I'm at home. I come into work. I get nagged at work. That is the story of my life. I didn't wash the dishes properly. Whatever it is. Mila doesn't want to go to school. She doesn't want to go to after school. She doesn't want to... She wants to take circus gymnastics anymore. She wants to take computers. Fine. I don't care. Get a job. She's 5.5 years old. She already should know how to use computers. How else is she going to get that data entry job? I stand in solidarity with my Republican brothers in Maine. Let the parents decide when the kids work. My kid is 5.5 years old, eats and eats and eats and eats, demands new clothes, grows out of the old clothes that we get her. It's time to put her to work. If she knows how to work a computer, then she can do a little data entry, perhaps maybe some customer service, like PayPal or something, based upon she'd be one of their top customer service people. Let's go to this story in Vanity Fair. The great Joseph Stiglitz, Nobel Prize-winning economist. He created, I had an opportunity to interview him for Breakroom Live, up in his office at Columbia. He created a theory about the inefficiency of markets when there is a disparity of information, some type of information asymmetry. That's what it is. In other words, one person goes to buy a car, and the seller of the car realizes that the car has been pulled out of a swamp in New Orleans and dried up, and the buyer doesn't know. Anyways, Stiglitz writes in Vanity Fair, the upper 1%, and this is a theme that I've been hitting quite a bit, but let's face it, folks, this is the new reality. The upper 1% of Americans are now taking in nearly a quarter of the nation's income every year. This is just the upper 1%. Is now taking a quarter of the nation's income every year. In terms of wealth, rather than income, the top 1% controls 40% of wealth. You get that distinction, correct, Evan? Mm-hmm. They control 40% of the nation's wealth. 1% of the people. 25 years ago, the corresponding figures were 12% and 33%. So they now receive 13% more income every year than they did 25 years ago, and they control 7% of the wealth more than they did 25 years ago. And 25 years ago was the mid-80s, right? 20 years ago? Holy crap. While the top 1% have seen their incomes rise 18% over the past decade, those in the middle, that's nearly the rest of us. That's basically 60% of the country, have actually seen their incomes fall. For men with only high school degrees, the decline has been precipitous, 12% in the last quarter century alone. All the growth in recent decades and more has gone to those at top. In terms of income inequality, America lags behind any country in Europe, and every country in Europe. Among our closest counterparts are Russia and Iran in terms of income disparity. Russia and Iran. Perhaps both places nice to visit. And the implications of this, according to Stiglitz, are multiple. One, opportunity for advancement in this in our society is falling sharply. Two, these income distortions actually make the economy less efficient. Further, this wealth concentration contributes to a tremendous lack of social investment, in other words, government investment in technology, in education, and in infrastructure, which, of course, like any investments, are the key to future economic growth. And this is all a function, these implications are a function of the fact that this top 1% has essentially bought our government. They control not only the economic process in our society, but the political process. And there's been study after study that have shown that. We've cited it on this program multiple times. Over the past 30, 40 years, regardless of who's in power, the policy preferences of the economic elite in this country always seem to win. And Stiglitz argues that the top 1% have the best houses, the best educations, the best doctors, the best lifestyles. But there is one thing that money doesn't seem to have bought, an understanding that their fate is bound up with how the other 99% live. Throughout history, this is something the top 1% eventually do learn too late. Now, I'm not as sanguine, if that's the word, about this as Joseph Stiglitz. You know, Chris Hedges had a very good point when we talked to him about the death of the liberal class. This 1%, they don't have to really care anymore. There was a time where the notion of social unrest, the notion of a backlash, the notion of a collapsed society was leverage against these people. But now they are so internationalized. You know, a listener of this program told me a great story a couple of weeks ago. And sometime during the 2008 election, she was at a fundraiser for a theater, and she was sitting next to Bob Rubin, the neoliberalite who brought us the deregulation of the banks, or was maybe the midwife to it, the handmaiden. And she had sent me an email years ago about this this encounter she had, where Rubin had sloughed off the idea of John Edwards winning because he was a populist. And at the time, I thought that was fairly interesting that he thought that. What was more interesting in retrospect is that he was in no way threatened by Obama. And but sometimes you hear the stories and you don't always glean the most important fact from it. Be that as it may, she told the story to me about Rubin on his way to this event. And he complained about the traffic. You know, of course, he takes a town car everywhere he goes. Probably a private one that, you know, who knows who pays for it. But the man certainly could have any number one of, you know, Citigroup getting paid millions of dollars for ostensibly having essentially allowed the creation of Citigroup. When he helped take down that Glass-Steagall Act, one of the direct beneficiaries were the Travelers Group and Citibank, who merged into Citigroup. Be that as it may, he complained about the traffic on the way onto the way to this event. That's why he was late. And she asked him, where was the traffic? I don't know. What do you mean you don't know? There was just traffic somewhere. Well, how did you get here? I don't pay attention. I don't know if I took an avenue. I don't know if I took a street. I don't know if it was the west side. I don't know if it was the east side. The man had absolutely no sense of the geography of New York City. But what he did do was to call the assistant mayor to complain about the traffic while he sat in this town car. Was unable to identify where the traffic was taking place. That was not the issue. Simply called, got the assistant mayor on the phone, presumably at 6 o'clock at night, 7 o'clock at night, en route to this fundraiser, and said, what's with all the traffic in New York City? And the mayor's assistant said, we'll look into it. This is how the uber rich in this country perceive this country. I mean, can you imagine getting stuck in traffic enough to the complain about it, not just to the person when you arrive at an event, but to the mayor's office and have no idea where the traffic was? Talk about the princess and the pea. And it is with this backdrop of what America has become in terms of this plutocracy that we are introduced to the Republican 2012 budget and have to wait to see if there's going to be a capitulation by the Obama administration. Now, Huffington Post is reporting only moments ago that the White House has rejected the GOP's proposal for a one-week funding measure, which would have cut billions upon billions of dollars. So we are headed to a government shutdown. Because the Republicans are determined, this has nothing to do with closing the deficit. Because you can close the deficit. You can have the deficit in a day with one vote. Return to the pre-Bush income tax levels, and you will have the deficit in one vote. But that's not what they're interested in. What they're interested in is what Naomi Klein outlines in Shock Doctrine, using this so-called economic crisis, and by so-called, I mean their version of an economic crisis is a debt crisis as opposed to the fact that we have no jobs, to cut government, to fundamentally alter the relationship between the citizens of this country and government. And if there is no budget deal by tonight, WAPO reports, there's general agreement that the two sides believe that if there is no deal by tonight, there's a certain amount of time that it would need to work its way through the House and the Senate. There's every reason to believe that the government will run out of money by Friday. So all non-essential government services will be shut down. Now, I wonder, and this is actually, I don't know the answer to this, and maybe somebody on the IM will be able to tell me. I wonder if that includes Medicaid, Medicare, Social Security. Are these non-essential government functions? I guess we'll find out. I guess we'll find out how the American public feels about these things not being paid. Because if you look at Paul Ryan's budget, Medicare, not essential. Medicaid, not essential. There is a full frontal assault on our providing assistance to poor people, to old people, all old people. So in his preview of his 2012 budget, Paul Ryan wrote, I think it was in the Wall Street Journal, our budget, which we call the path to prosperity.
Don't piss down my back and tell me it's raining.
That's actually the subtitle of it, the path to prosperity, and we're pissing down your back. And look, it's raining. It's very different. For starters, it cuts $6.2 trillion in spending from the president's budget over the next 10 years, reduces the debt as a percentage of the economy, puts the nation on a path to actually pay off our national debt. What does he hang his hat on? It is the growth that will be spurred by the economy with tax cuts. And this is his claim for growth. A study just released by the Heritage Center for Data Analysis projects that the path to prosperity will help create nearly 1 million new private sector jobs next year, bring the unemployment rate down to 4% by 2015, and result in 2.5 million additional private sector jobs in the last year of the decade. It spurs economic growth with $1.5 trillion in additional real GDP over the decade. According to the Heritage analysis, it would result in $1.1 trillion in higher wages and an average of $1,000 in an additional family income each year.
High on a hill was a lonely goat, her lay, hoodlay, hoodlay, now it was the voice.
This is coming from the Heritage Foundation. And Matt Iglesias asked the question, I wonder if the Heritage Foundation has ever looked at the myriad of benefits for tax cuts for the rich before. And it turns out they have.
Surprise, surprise.
Specifically, they promised us that George W. Bush's tax policies would lead the country into a brave new era of prosperity.
Hey, what happened?
Well, in fact, by the end of 2009, payroll employment in the United States was back down to 2001 levels despite population growth. That meant that payroll employment shrunk. It didn't add jobs, it stagnated wages, and it tanked our economy. And
surprise, surprise.
It ballooned surpluses to deficits. Or I should say, shrunk surpluses and then ballooned the deficits. Heritage also claimed Bush's tax cuts would boost tax revenue. This is what is known, and coincidentally perfectly, as the Laffer curve. By cutting taxes, people will become more productive. They won't go to Galt's Gulch. It will spur the economy, and it will grow the economy so fast that it will not only make up for the loss in revenue that you're not taking in taxes, but it will grow beyond that and raise revenue.
What are you talking about?
Well, sweetheart, this is the way Republicans pretend that tax cuts for plutocrats actually will benefit all of us.
Oh.
But in fact, it led to record deficits. They promised a surge in personal income when in fact we got the worst income performance ever. So, as Matt Iglesias says, keep in mind that this is the metric by which Paul Ryan wants you to judge him. If you believe George W. Bush unleashed an unprecedented economic boom with great jobs performance, rising incomes, and paying off the national debt, then you'll find a lot to like about Representative Ryan's plan. We're going to take a break. When we come back, we will dig into the implications of Representative Ryan's so-called cost controls on Medicare and Medicaid. Think about this. What does the words cost controls imply? I think I might impose some cost controls on my employees. Let me contemplate during the break how I might go about doing that. We'll be right back after this. Back, Sam Cedar, on the Majority Report. I came up with the solution during the break. How can I impose cost controls on my employee line item budget? And it's easy. I'm going to cut their pay in half. And in fact, that's what essentially Paul Ryan has come up with to control the costs that government spends on healthcare. He's not going to lower the cost of healthcare. He's simply going to say to old people, guess what? We're not going to help you out as much as we did before. I mean, that's it in a nutshell. But there's all sorts of games that they play. Merrill Guzner of the Fiscal Times has a very good breakdown here. Government spending on Medicare for seniors and Medicaid for the poor has grown nearly twice as fast as the rest of the economy for decades. Wow. Oh my God, there must be something wrong with government. They're spending twice as much on Medicare and Medicaid. But wait. Employer-based coverage for the working population, which is provided through private insurance companies, has grown just as fast.
Surprise, surprise.
In other words, healthcare costs more. It is not the delivery mechanism in which people pay for these healthcare costs that is rising. It is the costs themselves. So it's the cost and not the funding source here. The House Budget Committee Chairman's alternative budget would turn Medicare over to private insurers for anyone who retired after 2021. This is clever. In other words, we're going to screw you now, and you will not realize how badly you're screwed until you're too old to do anything about it, sucker. Future retirees would receive a capped payment to buy insurance. Basically, they called it premium support, but it's basically a voucher. You can take money. You can go buy private insurance. We're going to provide this to the states in a capped block grant, which basically says it's not going to be a function of how much seniors need. It's not going to be a function of how many seniors you have. This is the amount that you're going to get, and that's it. It is central to Ryan's cost control plan. But just because the government's loaded spending doesn't mean that old people and poor people won't have the same health care bills they had before. And in fact, those people who would be on Medicare and Medicaid, they're going to have the same bills that they did be in the past, but they're just going to be able to pay less for it. And who is going to pick up this bill? I will tell you right now. Anybody who's not on Medicaid, anybody who's not on Medicare, it is going to increase the costs of care across the board. How does this work? Basically, the rest of us will have to subsidize these people. Doctors in hospitals that take Medicare will have to make up the difference in revenue somewhere else. And that somewhere else is with their other patients. You see this in businesses all the time. I mean, you see it, frankly, you see it in this business. On some level, you know, we have many hardship memberships. On some level, other people are making up the cost. If we had 4 or 5 times the level of hardship members that we have on this show, we may actually have to raise the cost of a membership because of the server expenditures that we are having for people who can't pay. But you see it in other businesses all the time. One service basically subsidizes another service. And that's what we, and that's why we have one of the reasons, in addition to the sort of the methodology of providing medicine these days, it's one of the reasons why we raise care. Why we, raise costs across the board. One option for physicians and hospitals under a capped Medicare premium support system would be step up what they've always done with faced with inadequate Medicare reimbursement. They would shift even more costs to private non-Medicare payers, that is, employers and their covered employees. For working stiffs and their bosses, higher taxes would be replaced by higher insurance premiums. Another option would be for insurers to begin making skimpier plans available to seniors who would have to make up the additional costs on their out of their own pockets. Co-pays would rise. Deductibles would rise. Fewer services would be covered. Now, this is where conservatives have always argued that the reason why we have increasing medical costs in this country is because people are not rational consumers of health care. They believe that we should treat patients as if they were consumers. People don't shop around for the cheapest health care. They don't forego certain procedures that they need because they're not cost effective. Because we all know that every American has the sense to know whether or not they should get that MRI, or they should have that surgery, or they should address that ringing in their ear. Because we're all trained as paraphysicians. Because we all have access to the internet and we can diagnose ourselves. So if we have, I have a pain in my chest, it's going to be too expensive. It's going to make me a more responsible consumer of my healthcare. Now, this is the theory anyways. There has been extensive research that shows out-of-pocket expenses has consistently failed to hold down costs. On top of that, when people do self-ration their healthcare because of cost, what they end up doing is not knowing where they should cut back and letting problems grow. So, I see my engine light has come on. Not going to do anything about it. Or, I think I'm just going to skip this oil change. I'm going to cut back on just oil. A little cut here and there, and all of a sudden my engine seizes up. It's a bigger problem. Well, that's also sort of how human beings work as well. However, there is one way to avoid these negative outcomes. The government could set minimum standards for the insurance plans sold to seniors and the poor and set up exchanges, perhaps in the states, to enforce those standards. It could also guarantee that the premium support was adequate for poorer seniors to purchase those plans. There's a precedent for this approach. Republicans call it Obamacare. Democrats call it health care reform, which included an independent payment advisory board that every year after 2015 is going to recommend to Congress cuts in Medicare anytime expenditures go over GDP plus one. Republicans also want to repeal that part of the measure along with the rest of the bill. Princeton University health economist Reinhardt says that this plan by Ryan would lead to a multi-tiered health system with a highly financially constrained bare-bones system for tax-financed health insurance, a broad but varied set of tiers for private insurance patients, and a boutique tier for Americans able to afford that style of care. In other words, we'll become sort of like, I don't know, that system that they envision of when they talk about princes coming from Saudi Arabia to come get health insurance. That's right. I mean, healthcare, good healthcare will be available to the princes, to the barons, to the Robert Rubens, and the rest of you. You can suck it. And then on top of that, if the Democrats actually cave to any of Ryan's proposals, what can we expect? I'll tell you what we can expect. In 2012, they will run on this as the Democrats of cutting Medicare for old people and Medicaid for poor people. They will run on it just as they did in 2010 when $500 million was removed from essentially the part of Medicare that provided Medicare Advantage, which provided a huge boon to the private health industry and was replaced by Obamacare, as it were. And this is just an example of that. This is one of those ads that ran back in 2010.
Congress have cut Medicare $500 billion.
All right, play it again.
For Obamacare.
Play it again. Let's put the volume up.
Should Congress have cut Medicare $500 billion to...
Stop it. Play it. Just start it from the beginning. Because we missed the...
No.
Put the volume up. Now play.
Should Congress have cut Medicare $500 billion to pay for Obamacare? Renee Elmer says no. She says cutting Medicare hurts senior citizens. Bob Etheridge voted yes. He voted with President Obama to cut Medicare $500 billion. As long as Obama's in the White House, we can't let a Democrat represent us in Congress.
I'm Renee Elmers, and I approve this ad.
They ran against the Democrats for cutting Medicare. And even if they do it this time, they will run that way again. E.J. Dionne has a good piece in, I guess it was on Sunday, asking if President Obama will welcome the responsibility of engaging the country in this big argument as to how they want their government to work, what they want to be the relationship between their government and the people. Or will he shrink from it? Will his political advisors remain robotically obsessed with the poll results about the 2012 election? Or will they embrace Obama's historic obligation and opportunity to win the most important struggle of the role of government since the New Deal? I don't know. I am not holding my breath. But it is good to see, if this is the case, that the Obama administration has said either cut a deal now or be responsible for the government shutting down. We'll see how the Republicans do with that. We've got to take a break. When we come back, I will play you this audio from Victoria Jackson. It's a little bit old, but it's just too hilarious. Also, an update on what's going on in Wisconsin and some recent Supreme Court decisions. Basically, the only reason I can think of. Well, I shouldn't say that, but it is the primary reason why I will be voting for Obama in 2012, is the Supreme Court. We're going to take a break. We'll be right back. All right, we are back. Just one note that I gleaned from, I think it was Kyle's Twitter feed. I don't know if it was Kyle's. Somebody tweeted me this. I cannot remember what it was. Paul Barron, internet pioneer dies at 84. Now, this story will not make any sense to you whatsoever. And it's not for the reasons you think. Paul Barron, an engineer who helped create the technical underpinnings for the ARPANET, the government-sponsored precursor to today's internet, died Saturday night at his home in Palo Alto, California. He was 84 years old. Now, this is the part that is completely bizarre, totally ununderstandable. In the early 1960s, while working at the RAND Corporation in Santa Monica, California, Barron outlined the fundamentals for packaging data into discrete bundles, which he called message blocks. The bundles are then set on various paths around the network and reassembled at their destination. Such a plan is known as packet switching. Barron's idea was to build a distributed communications network less vulnerable to attack or disruption than conventional networks. In a series of technical papers published in the 1960s, he suggested that networks be designed with redundant routes to see that if a particular path failed or it was destroyed, messages could still be delivered through another. Barron's invention was so far ahead of its time that in the mid-1960s, when he approached AT&T with the idea to build his proposed network, the company insisted it would not work and refused. This is an impossibility, ladies and gentlemen. There is something completely fraudulent about this story. It is impossible that in the early 1960s, when we know the top marginal tax rate was at 91%, that anyone would dare to innovate in this way. Because we know that the Laffer curve makes it impossible for someone to attempt. How many billions of dollars has this idea ultimately been worth? It is impossible that someone would strive to innovate in this fashion at a time when the highest marginal tax rate was 91%. Are you kidding me? This is a lie. We know that God gave us the internet. It is the only way it could have shown up. It is the only way that the ARPANET was developed. It was God. God is the only one who does not care about a top marginal tax rate. This could not have happened at this time. This is obviously liberal propaganda. It's just a shame this man had to die to provide this type of liberal propaganda. Not possible. Simply not possible. The Laffer curve proves this man could not have innovated this. He obviously found it on his doorstep one morning. God had delivered it there. How do I know? Because she's my nun. She's my spiritual guru. I'm, of course, talking about Victoria Jackson. And the confluence of forces that combine in this audio is almost beyond my comprehension. She is on Showbiz Tonight, a show which I had no awareness was still on, talking to a VJ on Showbiz, or a DJ, or a host, or the anchor of Showbiz Tonight, some woman, I don't even know anything about it. And apparently there was a scene on the popular show Glee, which I am also completely unaware about, where two guys were making out. And they interviewed Victoria Jackson about it, because now apparently she is on the right-wing dole. I don't know what side she's writing at, but here's the first part of this interview.
Victoria, I've been reading the responses today on websites all over, and basically you are being accused of being homophobic. How do you respond to that?
Well, it doesn't matter what I think. What matters is what the Bible says. And I'm really concerned about our country, because immorality is, well, secular humanism rules the airwaves, and it's stealing the innocence away from this whole generation of children. My daughter's a teenager, and I can't find any show that she can watch.
So you don't believe you're homophobic. You just believe
that's a cute little buzzword of the liberal agenda. Basically, the Bible says homosexuality is a sin. But it has also, gossip is listed in the same paragraph as an equal sin. And the reason the Bible tells us what is a sin is to point us to the Savior and show us we need one, Jesus Christ. And I've noticed that the liberal agenda is anti-Christ, and I mean anti-Jesus.
Let's keep this focused on Glee and what you wrote about the show.
Well,
we posted
what
you wrote on our Showbiz Tonight Facebook.
Okay, so here she is on Showbiz Tonight, despite the fact that gossip is a sin as bad as homosexuality. She is just fantastic. Now, I could have easily presented to you this, like, this is a flashback. This is a sketch from Saturday Night Live in the mid-80s. But this is, let's just play the next clip. I want to invite her on. I want to invite her on this program. Let's play the next clip.
Victoria, do you understand the other side of the argument in defense of Glee? Some are saying the show could actually be helping kids.
Okay. I would like, no, it's not helping. They should have a celibacy campaign and tell kids that 50% of teenagers now have this new STD from oral sex. That's what they should be, you know, doing instead of trying to make kids gay. Now listen, I just want to know why the liberals are pro-Muslim and pro-gay. Muslims kill gays. That's what's confusing to me. And the only thing I can come up with is that the Muslims hate God and the gays hate
his
word.
You did also write about your concerns about Muslims.
So let's get this straight, folks. Muslim kill gays as opposed to, I remember those two Muslim extremists who killed Matthew Shepard. Oh, they were so Muslim. They were so Muslim extremists that they were not Muslim. I remember all of the gay bashing in this country performed by not Muslims. Then it's also extremist Muslims, the ones who think that they are following God's word by being extremists, also hate God. I'm going to have her on. I may hire her as a co-host. I may hire her as a co-host. I'll pay her to come on. We may do something like we would donate every aspect. We're going to go a little long today, folks, because I want to get through this news. Today, there's that big election in Wisconsin for the Supreme Court seat. The race is against David Prosser, a conservative, and a multi-year incumbent. It's against the Assistant Attorney General, Joanne Kloppenburg. Kloppenburg is not a very good candidate, has not run a very good campaign, but there's every reason to believe that Prosser is terrified of this because there's been a lot of corporate money dumped in there. It'll be interesting to A, see who wins, and B, what this does to the energy on the ground. It's going to be really shocking if she wins. It's just going to be shocking. 2 months ago, maybe it was 3 months ago, in February, there was a four-way multi-party primary. Prosser got 55% of the vote. Kloppenburg came in second with 25% of the vote out of four people. So there's not even a majority if she gets that other 20% that she didn't get. It's going to be interesting, though. Their internal polling that supposedly showed that Prosser is a dead heat. Kloppenburg's campaign organization has been so bad in her own political naivete. Last month, one organizer who offered to help the campaign said she was startled when a Kloppenburg staffer didn't know what GOTV stands for. Do you know what GOTV stands for?
Get out the vote.
You win a cookie. At the very least, a couple of the court cases sort of on hold for 2 months, the implementation of this bill, this could prove to be the determining factor in terms of whether or not the anti-union bill is actually implemented there. On top of that, simultaneous to that, the Wisconsin recall drive has already essentially broken all records. Friday afternoon, I think I mentioned this, but the final numbers are in. The recall drive against GOP State Senator Dan Kopachne In that district, they needed 15,588 signatures to trigger a recall. The final tally was 22,561. That's 145% of the total required. They did this in 29 days, which is less than half of the 60 days that they were allowed to do it. It tied the record for the fastest collection of signatures for a recall election in Wisconsin state history. There have been only two successful recalls of state legislators in Wisconsin history, against former state senators George Pettock in 96, Gary George for corruption in 2003. George was subsequently convicted on felony charges. In the first case, the requisite signatures were filed on the last day of the 60-day period, and in the second, it took 29 days. They racked up more signatures than necessary in the same amount of time that it took to rack up signatures against the guy who was a convicted, who ended up being a convicted felon. So there's a lot of history happening in Wisconsin. You wouldn't know it to watch the mainstream media, but what are you going to do? Meanwhile, I tweeted this out last night. Scott Walker hired a 27-year-old Brian DeShane, who has no college degree, very little management experience, two drunken driving convictions. Hired him at the beginning of the year for $67,000. Has already bumped him up to $81,000 a year. And just coincidentally, his father, Jerry DeShane, is a lobbyist for the Wisconsin Builders Association, which funneled essentially a total of 121,000 donations to Walker's campaign over the past 3 years, making one of the top five PAC donors to the government's successful campaign.
Surprise, surprise.
What a coinkydink. DeShane's father said he got the position himself, though he admits that during the gubernatorial contest, he might have reminded Keith Gilkes, Walker's campaign manager and now chief of staff, that his son was out there and available. How many members of David Koch's family do you think that guy from Buffalo, when he was pretending to be Koch, could have gotten hired on the Wisconsin payroll? The entire Koch family would have showed up. And finally, in Maine, Governor LePage, who literally took down that mural of Maine labor history, apparently is going to have to pay back like $40,000 of the federal grant for that thing if he doesn't put it back up. 63% of the murals, no, excuse me, murals' fair market value, which has likely gone up since it became a centerpiece in the Republican battle against workers. Hell, I'll claim that I'm going to buy that thing for $500,000. So LePage has yet to turn LePage on his little scuttlebutt with the mural. I'm going to have to get to the Supreme Court stuff tomorrow. We're way over time. Folks, you can IM me at Majority FM. We will head into the post show. I'll give you an update on Kyle's search for phones. I'll give you an update on the potential for hiring Victoria Jackson as a permanent. She'll do data entry. We'll talk about it in the post show. Not sure what we'll have later in the week. You'll have to tune in. See you on the flip side. Hey, folks, as I always say, your membership is the only thing that will ensure we can keep doing this show. So please, if you can, join today at majority.fm. Not only will you support the show, you'll get an extra 50 minutes of the show every day. But if you can't become a member, you can still support the show in other ways by virtually doing nothing. Head to majority.fm, find the Majority FM Amazon.com graphic, click on it, bookmark it, buy goods from Amazon as you normally would, and you'll actually be redistributing wealth from a corporate behemoth to the independent media you listen to daily. That means me. It's simple and it really helps. So please, if you can do it, do it. And you can also donate your Twitter account for one retweet daily at majority.fm. Thanks.